Welcome to Power to the People. Hello and welcome to Power to the People, your radio program brought to you by Democrats Abroad Global Black Caucus. I'm your host, Erica Smith. The month of February is dedicated to the celebration of Black History Month, initiated by Carter G. Woodson in 1926 as Black History Week, to highlight contributions of African Americans so often forgotten in American history. In this episode of Power to the People, we will continue our celebration of Black History Month with the life and times of an American prophet, James Baldwin.
Hey, yeah, we're the same brothers from a long time ago. We was talking about television and doing it on the radio. What we did was to help our generation realize they got to get out there and get busy because it wasn't going to be televised. We got respect for young rappers and the way they freeway in. But if you're going to be teaching folks things, be sure you know what you're saying. Older folks in our neighborhood got plenty of know-how. Remember, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be out there now. I ain't coming at you with no disrespect. All I'm saying is that you damn well got to be correct. Because if you're going to be speaking for a whole generation, and you know enough to try and handle their education, be sure you know the real deal about past situations and ain't just repeating what you heard on a local TV station. Sometimes they tell lies and put them in a truthful disguise. But the truth is, that's why we said it wouldn't be televised. They don't know what to say to our young folks, but they know that you do. And if they really knew the truth, why would they tell you? The first sign is peace. Tell all them gun-toting young brothers that the man is glad to see us out there killing one another. We raised too much hell when they were shooting us down, so they started poisoning our minds and trying to jerk us all around. And then they tell us they got to come in and control our situation. They want half of us on dope and the other half in incarceration. If the ones they want dead ain't killed by what they instigated, they can put some dope on the brother's body and claim it was drug-related. Tell them drug-related means there don't need to be no investigation, or at least that's the way they're gonna play it on the local TV station. All your 9mm brothers, give them something to think about. Tell them you heard that this is the new word. They got to work that stuff out. Because somehow they're feeling the wrong way with a gun in their hands. They're feeling real independent, but they just pulling contracts with a man. 5 and 5 will tell you it's hopeless out there on the avenue, but if they really knew the truth, why would they tell you? And if they look at you like you're insane and they start calling you scarecrow and say you ain't got no brain, or start telling folks that you suddenly gone lame, or that white folks have finally co-opted your game, or worse yet, implying that you don't really know, that's the same thing they said about us a long time ago. Young rappers, one more suggestion before I get out of your way. But I appreciate the respect you give me and what you got to say. I'm saying protect your community and spread that respect around. Tell brothers and sisters they got to calm that bullshit down. Because we're terrorizing our old folks and we brought fear into our homes. And they ain't got to hang out with the senior citizens. Just tell them, damn it, leave the old folks alone. And we know who ripping off the neighborhood. Tell them that BS has got to stop. Tell them you're sorry they can't handle it out there, but they got to take the crime off the block. And if they look at you like they think you're insane, or start calling you scarecrow thinking you ain't got no brain, or start telling folks that you suddenly gone lame, or that white folks have suddenly co-opted your game, or worse yet, saying that you really don't know, that's the same thing they said about me a long time ago. And if they tell folks that you finally lost your nerve, that's the same thing they said about us when we said Johannesburg. But I think you young folks need to know that things don't go both ways. You can't talk respect on every other song or just every other day. What I'm speaking on now is the raps about the women folks. On one song, she's your African queen, and on the next one, she's a joke. And you ain't said no words that I haven't heard, but that ain't no compliment. It only insults 8 people out of 10 and questions your intelligence. 4-letter words or 4-syllable words won't make you a poet. It will only magnify how shallow you are and let everybody know it. And if they look at you like they think you're insane, or they call you scarecrow thinking you ain't got no brain, or start telling folks that you suddenly gone lame, or that the white folks have finally co-opted your game, or you really don't know, they said that about me a long time ago. If they finally start telling people that you lost your nerve, that's what they said about Johannesburg. You ain't insane. You have got a brain. You haven't gone lame. You have got your game. Remember, keep the nerve. Keep the nerve. Keep the nerve. Keep the nerve. We're talking about peace.
James Baldwin was born August 22, 1924 in Harlem. He was known for his literature and critiques of the U.S. He spent time abroad where he could get not only a better view of the U.S., but also created safe space for his writing and creativity. Prolific writer about the racial conflicts in the United States and abroad, he was an author of several books and essays. One of those pivotal books was Go Tell It on the Mountain, published in 1953. He spent 3 months in isolation to complete the book. Go Tell It on a Mountain was a mirror of James Baldwin's life when he was younger. The book follows the young John Grimes in the 30s in Harlem, where John was to navigate his existence, his sexuality, his relationship with his father, also a pastor like Baldwin's, racism, and the place of religion within the African-American community.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, let me stand. I'm tired, I'm weak, I'm worn through storm. Through the night, lead me on to the light. Precious Lord, take my hand and lead me on.
Baldwin's mother, Emma Bardis Jones, and stepfather, David Baldwin, whom he called his father, had 8 children together. Baldwin had an extremely difficult relationship with his father David, but still followed him into the life of ministry. Between the ages of 14 and 16, Baldwin succeeded in bringing more people into the Fireside Pentecostal Assembly than his father. However, by the age of 17, he had a very different vision of Christianity, one as being oppressive for African Americans, but at the same time he lauded the religion for its ability to give people hope and courage to fight against oppression. James Baldwin's love of literature led to his love of writing. He was encouraged by his teachers to develop his many literary talents. While attending school at Harlem's PS 24, he even wrote the school song. Let's take a listen to an extract from the documentary, The Price of the Ticket, where James Baldwin's brother David shares that experience.
He did a play when I was very, very small. He had to be very small himself. He could have had, must have been about 8 or 9 years old when he wrote his first play. And he also wrote the school song, which they used until the school closed down. The whole family went to the school, PS 24, 128th Street, between 5th and Madison. And everyone had to sing this same song. If I can remember, let's see. Farewell, farewell to 24. We shall miss you evermore. We hate to say goodbye to you. That's what we all must know. To teachers we must say goodbye. And to our friends, oh my, we grieve to say we're very sad. But going forward is a thought to make us glad. And this is something, you know, we all went through. And it's one of the things, I guess, that you never forget.
Life for James Baldwin was very difficult at home. He found peace and joy reading at the library as an escape. The library also served as a haven from police brutality. A horrible encounter with the police at the age of 10 left Baldwin scarred for life, yet brought him to write an essay entitled A Report from the Occupied Territory, published in The Nation on July 11, 1966, with just as much relevance then as ever. 3 years prior to his article written in The Nation in 1963, James Baldwin, along with Lorraine Hansberry, Harry Belafonte, Kenneth Clark, Lena Horne, and actor Rip Torn, met with Attorney General Robert Kennedy at a Kennedy apartment on Central Park South, May 24, 1963. However, the most important person in the room was a New Orlean, Mr. Jerome Smith, a civil rights activist who famously spoke out against Robert Kennedy when he said, "I've seen you guys from the Justice Department stand around and take notes while we're being beaten." Lorraine Hansberry backed up Jerome by saying, "You've got a great many very, very accomplished people in this room, Mr. Attorney General, but the only man who should be listened to is that man over there. If you can't understand what this young man is saying, then we are without any hope at all, because you and your brother are representatives of the best that white America can offer. And if you are insensitive to this, then there's no alternative except our going in the streets and chaos." The next month, on June 11th, 1963, President John Kennedy asked for airtime on ABC, CBS, and NBC for an address on civil rights opposed by all of his cabinet except for his brother Robert. Here's an extract from the speech that President John F. Kennedy gave.
"We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if in short he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay? 100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not fully free. They are not yet freed from the bonds of injustice. They are not yet freed from social and economic oppression. And this nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be fully free until all its citizens are free.
I looked at the moon so full and so bright, and then at the fireplace with its flickering light, and realized why this world will never be right. Then I threw another log on the fire. Inside these four walls, I am a king. But beyond that door, it doesn't mean a thing. I pay all my dues till I have only a partial membership in world happenings. And my blood runs freely in Vietnam. So I threw another log on the fire. Why do you insist on keeping us caged? You know, all that does is intensify rage. The word now is seize the time. And all power to the people.
Power to the people!
A mandala!
A mandala!
Then I threw another log on the fire. Putting us in a cage was a mistake. All that did was intensify hate. Now shackled to our cages, you expect us to wait while you fool around on the moon and from there look for another place to conquer while I throw another log on the fire. America, you argue, is just doing fine. These racial things, however, do take time. Well, I'm tired of waiting and not getting mine.
Me too.
Except, however, in Vietnam, where every dead black man is a credit to his race, as long as he remembers his place. So I threw another log on the fire.
Let it burn.
Quick to put pencil to paper, can't wait. Must write, must explain before it's too late. The flames are at their peaks now, can't wait. Too many broken promises.
Too many.
Too many black babies asking why.
Too many.
Too many restless armies in the ghetto.
Too many.
So I'll just throw another log on the fire.
A man can walk proudly down any street. A man's not ashamed of what he believes. He knows how to laugh. He knows how to cry. He knows how to live. He's not afraid to die. What is a man? Tell me, tell me, tell me, tell me, Otis, what is a man?
James Baldwin had the heart, soul, and courage to speak truth to a nation that, though stood for liberty and justice for all, but denied basic rights to African Americans who built the nation from the ground up to create the United States as we know it today. The social injustices that James Baldwin experienced and witnessed also led him to speak out against racism as a construct that whites needed to deal with, as it was something they had created. In 1965, he participated in a debate against William F. Buckley at Cambridge University on the topic of "Is the American Dream at the Detriment of Black Americans?" Here's James Baldwin in his own words during that debate, a must-see from beginning to end.
What is relevant about this? Is that whereas 40 years ago when I was born, the question of having to deal with what is unspoken by the subjugated, what is never said to the master, of having to deal with this reality was a very remote possibility. It was in no one's mind. When I was growing up, I was taught in American history books that Africa had no history, and neither did I. That I was a savage, about whom the less said the better, who had been saved by Europe and brought to America. And of course, I believed it. I didn't have much choice. Those were the only books there were. Everyone else seemed to agree. If you walk out of Harlem, ride out of Harlem, downtown, the world agrees. What you see is much bigger, cleaner, whiter, richer, safer than where you are. They collect the garbage. People obviously can pay their life insurance. The children look happy, safe. You're not. And you go back home. And it would seem then, of course, that it's an act of God, that this is true, that you belong where white people have put you. It is only since the Second World War that there's been a counter image in the world. And that image has not come about through any legislation on the part of any American government, but through the fact that Africa was suddenly on the stage of the world, and Africans had to be dealt with in a way they'd never been dealt with before. This gave an American Negro, for the first time, a sense of himself beyond a savage or a clown. It has created, and will create, a great many conundrums. One of the great things that the white world does not know, but I think I do know, is that black people are just like everybody else. One has used the myth of Negro and the myth of color to pretend and to assume that you are dealing essentially with something exotic, bizarre, and practically, according to human laws, unknown. Alas, that is not true. We are also mercenaries, dictators, murderers, liars. We are human too. What is crucial here is that unless we can manage to establish some kind of dialogue between those people whom I pretend have paid for the American dream and those other people who have not achieved it, we will be in terrible trouble. I want to say at the end, at the last, is that that is what concerns me most. We are sitting in this room, and we are all, at least we like to think we are, relatively civilized. And we can talk to each other, at least on certain levels. So that we could walk out of here assuming that the measure of our enlightenment, or at least our politeness, has some effect on the world. It may not. I remember, for example, when the ex-Attorney General, Mr. Robert Kennedy, said that it was conceivable that in 40 years in America we might have a Negro president. And that sounded like a very emancipated statement, I suppose, to white people. They were not in Harlem when this statement was first heard, and did not hear, and possibly will never hear, the laughter and the bitterness and the scorn with which the statement was greeted. From the point of view of the man in the Harlem barbershop, Bobby Kennedy only got here yesterday. And now he's already on his way to the presidency. We've been here for 400 years, and now he tells us that maybe in 40 years, if you're good, we may let you become president. What is dangerous here is the turning away from anything any white American says. The reason for the political hesitation and in spite of the Johnson landslide is the one that's been betrayed by American politicians for so long. And I'm a grown man, and perhaps I can be reasoned with. I certainly hope I can be. But I don't know, and neither does Martin Luther King, none of us know, how to deal with those other people whom the white world has so long ignored, who don't believe anything the white world says and don't entirely believe anything I or Martin say. And one can't blame them. You watch what has happened to them in less than 20 years. It seems to me that the city of New York, for example, this is my last point, which is that Negroes in it for a very long time. If the city of New York were able, as it has indeed been able, in the last 15 years to reconstruct itself, tear down buildings and raise great new ones, downtown and for money, and has done nothing whatever except build housing projects in the ghetto for the Negroes, and of course the Negroes hate it. Presently the property does indeed deteriorate because the children cannot bear it. They want to get out of the ghetto. If the American pretensions were based on a more solid, a more honest assessment of life and of themselves, it would not mean for Negroes, when someone says urban renewal that Negroes simply are going to be thrown out into the streets, which is what it does mean now. This is not an act of God. We're dealing with a society made and ruled by men. If the American Negro had not been present in America, I am convinced that the history of the American labor movement would be much more edifying than it is. It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them. And until that moment, until the moment comes when we, the American people, are able to accept the fact that I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other, and that I am not a ward of America. I am not an object of missionary charity. I am one of the people who built the country. Until this moment, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream, because the people who are denied participation in it, by their very presence, will wreck it. And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West. Thank you.
The last literary work of James Baldwin was an incomplete manuscript, Remember This House, started in 1979. The manuscript was brought back to life by Raoul Peck in 2016, nearly 20 years after Baldwin's death, in the form of a documentary, I Am Not Your Negro. Here's an extract of the documentary when James Baldwin was speaking on the future of African Americans.
I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive. But the Negro in this country, the future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people and our representatives. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they maligned so long. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. The question you've got to ask yourself, the white population of this country has got to ask itself, north and south, because it's one country, and for a Negro, there is no difference in the north and the south. There's just a difference in the way they, in a way they castrate you. But the fact of the castration is the American fact. If I'm not the nigger here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you've got to find out why.
James Baldwin's words still ring true 50 years after he first spoke them. We will leave you with the words of Mr. James Baldwin during his interview with Mr. Kenneth Clark on his program entitled Perspectives, when they were speaking about the Negro and the American promise. And as always, stay tuned for more from Power to the People, brought to you by Democrats Abroad Global Black Caucus. Thank you for being with us, and until next time, continue sharing your power with the people, for the people, by the people, and to the people. If you have a few minutes to spare, stick around and continue listening for the bonus information after James Baldwin's interview with Dr. Kenneth Clark.
We managed to record this conversation with James Baldwin immediately after both of us attended that now famous meeting between a group of Mr. Baldwin's friends and Attorney General Robert Kennedy. I believe much of the emotion of that historic occasion spilled over into our conversation. In an attempt to ease the tension, I started by asking him to dig back and tell us something about his childhood and his growing up.
I was born in Harlem, Harlem Hospital. We grew up on Park Avenue, Uptown Park Avenue, where the railroad tracks are. We used to play on the roof and in the, I can't call it an alley, but near the river. It was a kind of dump, garbage dump. So those are the first scenes I remember. I remember my father had trouble keeping us alive. There were 9 of us. I was the oldest, so I took care of the kids. I understand much better now. Part of his problem was he couldn't feed his kids. But I was a kid and I didn't know that. And he was very religious, very rigid. He kept us together, I must say. And when I look back on it, after all, it was nearly 40 years ago that I was born. I think back on my growing up, and walk to that same block today because it's still there. And think of the kids on that block now. I'm aware that something terrible has happened, which is very hard to describe. I am, in all but no technical legal fact, a southerner. My father was born in the South. No, my mother was born in the South. And if they had waited 2 more seconds, I might have been born in the South. But that means that I was raised by a family whose roots were essentially rural and whose relationship to the church was very direct, because it was the only means they had of expressing their pain and their despair. But 20 years later, the moral authority, which was present in the Negro northern community when I was growing up, has vanished. People talk about progress, and I look at Harlem, which I really know. I know it like I know my hand. And it is much worse there today than it was when I was growing up.
Would you say this is true of the schools, too?
It's much worse in the schools. I went to PS 24, PS 139, and I remember coming home from school, and my mother asked me, my teacher was colored or white, and I said she was a little bit colored, a little bit white, because she was about your color. And as a matter of fact, I was right. That's part of the dilemma of being an American Negro, that one is a little bit colored and a little bit white. And not only in physical terms, but in the head and in the heart. And there are days, this is one of them, when you wonder what your role is in this country and what your future is in it. How precisely you're going to reconcile yourself to your situation here, and how you're going to communicate to the vast, heedless, unthinking, cruel white majority that you are here. And to be here means that you can't be anywhere else. I'm terrified at the moral apathy, the death of the heart, which is happening in my country. These people have rooted themselves for so long. They really don't think I'm human. I have basis on their conduct, not on what they say. And this means that they have become, in themselves, moral monsters. In a free country.
In a free country.
In the middle of the 20th century.
What do you think can be done to change the moral fiber of America?
I think the one has got to find some way of putting the present administration of this country on the spot. One has got to force somehow from Washington a moral commitment, not to the Negro people, but to the life of this country. It doesn't matter any longer, and I'm speaking for myself, for Jimmy Baldwin, and I think I'm speaking for a great many other Negroes too. It doesn't matter any longer what you do to me. You can put me in jail, you can kill me. By the time I was 17, you'd done everything that you could do to me. The problem now is, how are you going to save yourselves? It was a great shock to me. The Attorney General, Mr. Robert Kennedy, did not know that I would have trouble convincing my nephew to go to Cuba, for example, to liberate the Cubans in defense of a government which now says it is doing everything it can, which cannot liberate me. Now, there are 20 million people in this country, and you can't put them all in jail. And I know how my nephew feels. I know how I feel. I know how the cats in the barbershop feel. A boy last week, who was 16 in San Francisco, told me on television, thank God we got in control. Maybe somebody will start to listen. He said, I got no country, I got no flag. Now he's only 16 years old. And I couldn't say you do. I don't have any evidence to prove that he does. They were tearing down his house because San Francisco is engaging, as most northern cities now are engaged, in something called urban renewal, which means moving the Negroes out. It means Negro removal. That is what it means. And the federal government is an accomplice to this fact. We're talking about human beings. There's not such a thing as a monolithic wall or, you know, some abstraction called the Negro problem. These Negro boys and girls who at 16 and 17 don't believe the country means anything that it says, don't feel they have any place here on the basis of the performance of the entire country.
But there is this picture of young Negro college students. Could you react to the student nonviolent movement, which has made
such an impact, which has affected both Negroes and whites?
Well, of course, one of the things I think that happened, really, is that in the first place, the Negro has never been as docile as white Americans wanted to believe. That was a myth. We were not singing and dancing down the levee. We were trying to keep alive. We were trying to survive a very brutal system. The Negro has never been happy in his place. What those kids, first of all, prove, first of all, that they prove that. They come from a long line of fighters. And what they also prove is not that the Negro has changed, but that the country has arrived at a place where it can no longer contain the revolt, as it could do once. Let's say I was a Negro college president, and I needed a new chemistry lab. So I was a Negro leader, because the white man said I was. And I came to get the new chemistry lab. And the type of price I paid for the chemistry lab was to control the people I represented. And now, I can't do that. We were talking to Negro students afterwards. They've been through it all. He's half dead. That's an awful lot to ask a person to bear. The country sat back in admiration of all those kids for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And has not lifted a finger to help. Now, we all knew, I know you knew and I knew too, that a moment was coming when we couldn't guarantee, that no one can guarantee, that it won't reach the breaking point. You can only survive so many beatings, so much humiliation, so much despair, so many broken promises, before something gives. Human beings are not by nature nonviolent. Those children had to go, had to pay a terrible price in discipline, in moral discipline, in interior effort and courage, which the country cannot imagine, because it still thinks Gary Cooper, for example, was a man.
Sector cannot expect them to remain nonviolent.
No, you can't. You can't. And furthermore, there were always these students that we're talking about. When I was in Tallahassee, there were some students protesting, a minority. But there were many, 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 many more students who had given up, who were desperate, and who Malcolm X can reach, for example, much more easily than I can. When Malcolm tells them, in effect, is that they should be proud of being black, and God knows that they should be. That's a very important thing to hear. Of course, in order to do this, what he does is destroy a truth and invent a history. What he does is say, you're better because you're black. Well, of course, that isn't true. That's the trouble. It is the only movement in the country which we can call grassroots. I hate to say that, but it's true. When Malcolm talks, or one of the Muslim ministers talk, they articulate for all the Negro people who hear them, who listen to them. They articulate their suffering, the suffering which has been in this country so long denied. That's Malcolm's great authority over any of his audiences. He corroborates their reality.
This is more effective appeal than the appeal of Martin Luther King.
It's much more sinister because it is much more effective. It's much more effective because it is, after all, comparatively easy to invest a population with a false morale by giving a false sense of superiority. And it will always break down in a crisis. It's the history of Europe, simply. It's one of the reasons we're in this terrible place. It's one of the reasons we have 5 cops standing on a black woman's neck in Birmingham. Because at some point they believed, they were taught and they believed that they were better than other people because they were white. It leads to a moral bankruptcy. It is inevitable. It cannot but lead there. My point here is that the country is for the first time worried about the Muslim movement. It shouldn't be worried about the Muslim movement. That's not the problem. The problem is to eliminate the conditions which breed the Muslim movement.
Well, I'd like to come back to get some of your thoughts about the relationship between Martin Luther King's appeal, that is effectively yes. Non-violent, and his philosophy of disciplined love for the oppressor. What is the relationship between this and the reality of the Negro masses?
Well, Martin's very rare, very great man. Martin's rare for 2 reasons. Part because just because he is. And because he's a real Christian, and he really believes in nonviolence. He's arrived at something in himself. And he still has great moral authority in the South. There's none whatever in the North. Poor Martin has gone through God knows what kind of hell to awaken the American conscience. But Martin has reached the end of his rope. There's some things Martin can't do. Martin's only one man. Martin can't solve the nation's central problem by himself. There are lots of people, lots of black people, I mean now, who don't go to church no more and don't listen to Martin. And who anyway are themselves produced by civilization, which is always glorified violence, unless the Negro had the gun. Martin is undercut by the performance of the country. The country is only concerned about nonviolence if it seems that I'm going to get violent. It's not worried about nonviolence if it's some Alabama sheriff.
What do you see as the future of our nation? Are you essentially optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, I'm both glad and sorry you asked me that question. I'll do my best to answer it. I can't be a pessimist because I'm alive. To be a pessimist means that you have agreed that human life is an academic matter. So I'm forced to be an optimist. I'm forced to believe that we can survive whatever we must survive. But the future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. It is entirely up to the American people and our representatives. It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they've maligned so long. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. The question you got to ask yourself, the white population of this country has got to ask itself, north and south, because it's one country, and for a Negro, there's no difference between north and the south. There's just a difference in the way they, in a way they castrate you. But the fact of the castration is the American fact. If I'm not the nigger here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you got to find out why. And the future of the country depends on that, whether or not it's able to ask that question.
Dear listeners, if you would like to hear the extracts in their entirety, they are all available online. In your search engine, type Global Black Caucus Power to the People, which will take you to our podcast on Podomatic. You can also find out more about Democrats Abroad Global Black Caucus and how to join at www.democratsabroad.org/BC, as well as from DA Global Black Caucus's Facebook page. You can find the resources used on the show and others at the L31 Project as well.